Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm Fred Monroe. I'm glad you're with us today. Our topic today is immigration issues at the border and in our communities and beyond. 2 years ago, a small group of concerned community members came together and they put together a group that was, well, it came together primarily not as a group originally, but it came together as a way to support a Guatemalan family in the local area who was seeking asylum. The organization is now known as the Allies for Immigrant Justice, and it was born from this original group of people helping this Guatemalan family. They're dedicated to working with community organizations and faith groups and concerned individuals. They envision a country, not just a county, but a country where all people, regardless of immigration status, are treated with respect and dignity and have access to a fulfilling and prosperous political, economic, and social life. Joining me today are Gina Whitaker and Jan Meslin, and they are from the organization Allies for Immigration Justice. And we want to discuss how working together as a community can help support those immigrants within our community and get a better understanding of those. This is a generally, historically right now, a very political topic. I personally look at it more as a human rights topic, and I think we need to understand how that balance works out. I think some things in our society have done a lot towards making it more political than it needs to be. So I think we need to discuss how we can fit that all together. I want to remind listeners that this is a call-in program. You're welcome to call in at any time in the program at 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. I encourage you, if you want to be part of this discussion, to call in as early in the program as you are comfortable, because we'd find sometimes when folks are calling in the last 10 or 15 minutes, we really don't have time to address their concerns. So Gina and Jan are with us today, and they're going to help me better understand how we can work with the immigrant communities that we have, both in our county and nationally. How did this organization come about starting?
Well, as you mentioned, a group of us got together. We felt like we wanted to do more to support immigrant families and to counter some of the injustices that we felt were happening. We are basically a grassroots group of individuals in both San Luis Obispo County and Santa Maria Valley, and we're dedicated to working with community organizations and faith groups and concerned individuals in order to take action to support immigrant communities. We advocate, we educate, and we support. And I can give you examples of how we do that, but I think that's enough for this question right now.
And this is Jan here. I moved to this area about 7 months ago from Orange County, kind of a hotbed of a lot of immigration injustice. And I just was happy to find this group, Allies for Immigration Justice. I've been working in immigration justice work for many years, mostly with a group I'm still with now called Freedom for Immigrants. And our mission is to abolish immigration detention. And until we can do that, we have visitation programs all around the country. There are more than 200 detention centers, and so we visit and advocate for people. That's what I've been doing, and it's through making friends and hearing stories of people that has just made me very passionate about this work.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to mention too, Fred, is that we're people just like our listeners. We're learning as we go. We are passionate about this topic. We will answer questions the best way we can, but we are not experts.
Very good point, Gina. Thank you.
Yes.
One of the things, just as hearing your opening remarks and looking at some of the information you provided for us, I want to share a perspective from myself that I think comes into play a lot of times with what you're working with. There are people who find there's a double standard for individuals. Not a double standard among individuals, but I think every individual sometimes has a double standard. And that is people that they know that are from immigrant families, and we're all, unless you're a Native American, we are all at some point from an immigrant family.
Mm-hmm.
But they seemed, oftentimes I hear people comment that they perceive immigration as a big problem except when it relates to the people they already know in their community that they feel have been integrated into their community. And I'm wondering if that's the kind of dilemma that you deal with on a regular basis when people are looking at whether or not we have concerns for immigrants or an immigrant problem. And I'm wondering how that may fit in your perspective.
The thing about immigration policy and immigration activity is that it's super complex. It's really complex issue. There is the political end of it with policy setting. There's the humanitarian aspect. And I think that could be best addressed by helping people understand the big picture. And the big picture means there are thousands of people coming to our borders seeking a better life for themselves. And I hope we'll be able to, you know, help educate people as to what is an asylum seeker and what used to be the case and is now different about coming to the country, whether there's a line to get into or not. As people mentioned, why don't they just get in line? So a lot of our questions are guided by misconceptions, and we hope we'll be able to clear some of those up.
But to answer that a little bit more, and what was your question?
It was about how exceptions are made.
Yes, people, I understand.
They perceive that the people they know that are immigrants are all nice, wonderful people, and everybody else is the problem.
It's the same as with so many issues today: healthcare, justice, climate change. Until it affects you personally or your family personally, you don't really feel connected and you don't really care. But then all of a sudden you care, and so. Part of this is just all of these issues are really related, and it's about human dignity and it's about humanity. And so that's kind of the concentration why we continue this work and why we have hope, because there's a lot of things going on too.
Yeah. Can we look at a little history about how you formed as a group? Because in the notes that you provided us, there was reference to the Guatemalan family that you've done some work with. So I'm wondering how this became an evolved process for the two of you.
We did start as a group of people supporting an immigrant family who was seeking asylum right here in our own county. And Mary Lynn Crandall was one of the group that was helping support this family, and she felt like she wanted to do more. She wanted to broaden our work. And so four of us broke off from that group. We're still part of that group, but we broke off and formed Allies for Immigration Justice. We felt like we could learn. We had so much to learn, and we could learn more about other organizations that were doing this work and emulate some of that here in our county.
So an awful lot of people, the recurring theme I hear a lot about is that all these immigrants are taking jobs for people who are already here legally. And that's, I'm sure that's an issue that you've heard a lot. And how do you respond to that?
Well,
by the way, I want you to make real clear, that's a question I'm asking on behalf of what seems to be a common view. It is not a view that I hold myself.
Right. I have a response to that, Fred, and I would like to present that in a little different way. Let me see. I need to find. Here we go.
Yeah.
Okay. The idea that illegal immigrants or immigrants are taking good jobs from U.S. citizens is prevalent. The question is not as simple as it sounds. Think about this. What jobs are they talking about? Are we talking about undocumented immigrants or immigrants with work permits who may be legal permanent residents? They may have all their documentation. What are employers willing to pay? And are non-immigrant U.S. citizens willing to work for that wage? So we have to think about this from an economic standpoint, too. But those are the questions that came up for me when I gave thought to this. If we want inexpensive food at restaurants, if we want cheap produce at the farmers market, if we want less housing costs with non-union jobs, sometimes the only people that are willing to work under those conditions for low wages are immigrants or are people who are so poverty-stricken that they really don't have a choice.
And if they're undocumented, a whole nother level gets added because they're exploited. Some of the owners will not even pay them. They'll promise them. There's wage theft. It's a big problem. Yeah. You can exploit people because they're living in the shadows and they're scared.
Yeah.
So.
Jen, you bring up a key point, and that is that we've heard a lot about this in the last few months. INS is efforts to basically remove workers in workplace environments where they come in and round up a series of people that they then discover are illegal or believe were illegal. My hunch is those people never see the paycheck that for the work that they've done when they get rounded up.
Sometimes,
The government. I guess I'm real unclear as to why the firms that hire people that the government deems not employable are never held responsible for what they're doing.
Yeah, I don't have an answer to that question.
I'm sorry you don't have an answer, and I'm not surprised you don't, because I'm not sure anybody has a clear answer about that at the moment.
Very sad. And a lot of those people in those raids, I mean, it's illegal to work without a work permit.
Mm-hmm.
And so they end up going into the detention and deportation system, which is...
And I know,
affects so many people, their families, and so much. Go ahead.
I know that our local farmers here, we're in an agricultural county here, and so many of the growers are struggling for lack of workers. Part of that is related to housing. There are legal ways for people to come and work here. It's called an H-1B visa, but the housing has to be provided by the grower, by the employer, and this is a big problem here. So everything is very interrelated on these issues. There's no one answer or one solution to why it seems as though people experience quote-unquote immigrants are taking jobs that Americans would rather, you know, be getting.
Is the average person that you talk to in the community supportive of what you're doing and believe this is a positive issue, or are they skeptical on a regular basis? Jan gets off the hook because she's only lived here for a few months. Gina's lived here for a very, very long
40
time.
Years.
Yeah. How many years?
More than 40, wow. Around 42 years. I would say that most of the people I talk to are very compassionate about these issues. I'm guilty, as many of us are, of not having a lot of opportunity or spending a lot of time talking to people who disagree with me. And I know that's a failing on my part, because I would like to be able to ask those folks who are often so hateful toward immigrants, where's the compassion? You know, how can they get in touch with their compassionate self? Sometimes their son or daughter marries an immigrant. That changes things in their family. Their attitudes may change if that happens. So I don't really know what else to say about that, but I find that most people are very compassionate. We have a lot of attendance at our events. 90 to 100 people came to view a film called Harvest of Empire, which we'll talk about later, which is an excellent look at the history of American relations with Latin America. And we have, you know, several 1,500 people showed up at the rally around separating families a couple of years ago. So I think there's a lot of people out there with compassion for this problem and really would love to see a solution.
And adding on to that, there's people, so many people are really disturbed by the actions of the last couple years. And, you know, especially the detention of children kind of added a whole nother mm-hmm. level. But a lot of things that have happened, and they just get heartbroken and they feel helpless and they want to do something. And so we'll have some suggestions later on of ways people can get involved, because just they keep seeing it every day and they get kind of overloaded with all this bad stuff and they're frustrated and they don't know what to do. So
what is to get a better understanding, when someone comes to the border, in most cases it's the southern border, mm-hmm. Seeking asylum, yeah. What is the process that individual needs to go through, and how do they progress through that process? Because if we're far enough from the border that if you had a Guatemalan family that you were working with that was living already in San Luis Obispo County, mm-hmm. I mean, we need to be realistic. They somehow came across the southern border, got asylum status in some fashion, and were able to then live in San Luis Obispo County. So I think to some extent, we understand the concept of being an asylum seeker. Mm-hmm. I think most of us don't understand what the process is that those individuals have to go through.
Okay, well, there is a process. It is definitely legal to seek asylum. The definition of an asylum seeker is somebody who feels like they're persecuted in their own country and they need to flee. They just can no longer live there. They're not safe, and they're unable or unwilling to stay there. So they come to another country. For example, that we get so many people in Tijuana, and we've both recently been there to observe some of these things. What they do is they ask for asylum at a port of entry. Tijuana is the biggest one where more people ask than anywhere in the U.S. And then in the past, they were able to be seen by an asylum officer when they asked for asylum. And oftentimes they would be, if they had family in the United States, they would be released. They'd see a judge and they would be released to live with their family while they work on their asylum case. They could have a credible fear interview. What they need to do, though, in order to win asylum, you need to prove that you have a fear of being persecuted because of your race, your religion, your nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion. Those are the only reasons you can win asylum. It used to be you would be either released, like I said, or if you didn't have family here, you would be put into detention while you work on your asylum case. This actually, before 1996, nobody had to go into detention, or nobody had to get these ankle monitors that some of them get. So this is kind of a recent thing. It's one reason the detention numbers have soared. But let me just mention the refugees are.
Yeah, let me get back
same.
To that in a minute,
okay.
If we can. Okay, because
sure.
we have a caller and I don't want them to just sit
thank
way
you.
Too long. So, no, hold on a second. Mary, you're on the air. Thanks for your patience.
Hi, no problem. I was just wondering if the people that are talking could talk a little bit about what's happening, why all of these people are coming, like what's happening in the countries where they're coming from that's making them make this journey to come to here to seek asylum.
Okay. So you're looking at an understanding of the motivation of asylum seekers.
Yeah, because I think that's a really important thing for us to know, you know, in order to understand the whole picture about what's happening.
Okay.
Gina?
Yeah. Gina, you have an answer?
I'll take the first part of that. There are several things that are happening in the countries south of the border. We really can't talk about asylum seekers from the Northern Triangle, which is Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, without knowing the history and understanding what's happening there now. This movement of people is often characterized as an economic migration, but that's only part of the story. The demographic of those coming to the U.S. has changed over the decades. It used to be single males looking for work and mostly coming from Mexico. They were migrating. They weren't generally seeking asylum. But now it's families fleeing domestic and gang violence from this Northern Triangle. And those three countries consistently rank as the most violent countries in the world. I know Jan has something to say about some of the other reasons of what's happening, gang violence and domestic violence especially.
Yeah, and it's not only the Northern Triangle also. The people that I've seen often are from Africa and Haiti and lots of parts of the world with the same reason they're leaving their countries for. A Doctors Without Borders report states that these Northern Triangle countries especially are experiencing unprecedented levels of violence outside a war zone. They're murdered with impunity. Kidnappings and extortion are daily occurrences. Gangs perpetuate insecurity and forcibly recruit individuals into their ranks. They use sexual violence as a tool of intimidation and control. Just recently, we were in Tijuana, and I just wanted to share a story of a young man and his family we met outside of a shelter. He was living in one shelter, and his wife and children were in another shelter. And he was living in rural Honduras with his family. When his job ended, they moved to a city in Honduras where he started a used clothing business. The drug gang in that city then approached him and demanded a monthly extortion fee, which he reluctantly paid. Eventually, they demanded that he help them to traffic drugs, which he refused to do. They went to his brother's house, beat up his brother and his wife, and they hurt their two-year-old child by slamming her into a doorway. And he said, "We realized we could no longer stay there, so we sold everything and began our journey to the U.S. border." When he presented himself at the border, he was placed in the Return to Mexico program, which we'll learn about in a little while, but that's where we met him. He and his family were waiting in Mexico to eventually get back to the U.S. for their court appointments. There's also climate refugees, and I don't know if this is the first time, maybe some of you have heard about that, but people are fleeing their countries because the drought is causing the crops to dry up and they can no longer feed their families. The coffee market collapse, it happened in Central American growers. They couldn't earn a living anymore. Prices have dropped so low that many coffee farmers in the region operate at a net loss. Severe drought in the Northern Triangle has caused this. And also flooding. You know, the climate refugees are another.
Mary, are you still on the line with us?
Yes, I am. Yeah, thank you very much. This is very interesting. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for calling and thanks for listening.
Thank you for calling.
Another thing that's happening in these countries is severe domestic violence. Guatemala and Honduras are two of the highest femicide rates. They have two of the highest femicide rates in the world, meaning women who are being murdered for being women. Sexual violence was used as a tool of war in the civil war in Guatemala from 1960 to 1996, and soldiers were trained to commit acts of violence against women as part of warfare. Then the culture of machismo already existed, and the outcome was the creation of a culture of violence toward women, including wives, girlfriends, and mothers. Unfortunately, when women report these situations to the local police, they are ignored. They do nothing. And the woman who you mentioned, who is known to us, who's seeking asylum here, fled a domestic violence. She was here, came here as a result of such violence, threats to her family as well as her own person. So the other, you know, there's repressive regimes in these countries too that operate.
Yeah. We can get back to that in a minute. I don't want to cut you off, but okay. I want to remind our listeners, because people sometimes, when they tune in, they may not have been with us for the early part of the program. We're talking about immigration issues at our border and in our communities and beyond, looking at how different people work with immigrant families or individuals seeking asylum. My guests today are Gina Whitaker and Jan Meslin. They're with a new organization in San Luis County called Allies for Immigrant Justice. Jan is also a staff volunteer for an organization called Freedom for Immigrants. You are welcome to call in and be part of this discussion. The phone number here is 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. I would remind you that the earlier in the program you call in, the more likely we are to have time to make sure to include your comments and observations or questions in the discussion. There has recently been a very large discussion, and I have to preface it with the fact that since this is a, in my mind, is a constitutional guarantee, I am surprised it has become such a large topic. But there seems to be this discussion going on now. Maybe it's a way to gain allies who are against immigration for in some cases, that allegedly pregnant women are coming to the United States just to have the privilege of having their child in the United States, which, by the way, would then make their child a U.S. citizen. That is a constitutional provision, and that's in my lifetime, and I'm in my late 60s, that particular topic has never been a critical immigration topic like it has in the last year or so. Are you hearing more about that, and how is it coming up in the discussions that you're having with folks?
I'm not really hearing that much more about that, but I have been asked that question, and you know, people have the idea that because that this will make that the woman has a baby here, that it will make her become a citizen or make her legal faster, but and get her in that. You know, people say, let's just get in line, like everyone else, and this will make that line go away for her. You know, but that is not true. That is not true. There really is no such thing as a line anymore. If you do have a baby in the United States and you're not legal and that person is a U.S. citizen, the only way they can that would help you to become legal later on is if they turn 21 years old. If you have a U.S. citizen child, 21 years, and then you would be able to get your green card maybe and then another few years to become a citizen. The only other way that could be faster is if you marry a U.S. citizen. But just coming here to have a baby is not going to get you legal right away.
But it seems to be we're hearing a lot about it as if it's an excuse to be concerned about immigrants for some people.
For some people. I think it's really a blessing for those babies that are born here because they are U.S. citizens. And I think our administration is even trying to end that constitutionally guaranteed situation that if you're born in the land of the United States of America, you are automatically a citizen of that land.
It's hard to change the Constitution.
Yeah, but it doesn't change the status of the woman who came here, perhaps without documentation. It doesn't change that to have a baby here. That baby is a citizen, but it doesn't change her situation.
Yeah, let's revisit that. We have, let's see, Barry, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Thanks for your patience. What are your thoughts and your questions?
I have a comment and a question, but first I just want to thank your guests for the work that they're doing. This is critically important work for people to bear witness to what's going on at the border and in the detention centers and communicate that to those of us who can't be there to see it ourselves. We need to know the facts, and I sincerely appreciate the work that your guests are doing. I have a comment about a comment that was made earlier about people coming here and taking away jobs from Americans. At the moment, we have one of the lowest unemployment rates in history. I'm a business owner, and anyone who is in business knows how difficult it is to find people to hire these days. Everybody in business is looking for people to hire, and they're not out there. And the fact of the matter is that we need more immigration and not less, especially as our population ages and our birth rate declines. We are going to need younger workers coming in. And so I just wanted to comment about that. My question is, we've talked and your guests have advocated ending the current system of detention and deportation and making people wait in Mexico, sending them back to Mexico to wait. And I'm just wondering, what if we were to defund ICE and CBP and end the current system, what would they like to see to replace the current system? What are the alternatives that we have to the current inhumane system? And I'll hang up and listen to the answer.
Great. Thanks for your comments.
I could talk a long time about that. Yeah, we want a humane system, first of all. Immigration detention is definitely not humane because it is incarcerating people simply for not having proper documents. And there's lots of abuses that go on inside detention. And if they could be out living with their families while they work on their cases, whether it be their asylum case or just fighting their deportation, which is the reason a lot of people are in detention, they would have a much better chance of winning their cases. While they're in detention, they don't. So I've been advocating, along with Freedom for Immigrants and many other groups, for true alternatives to detention. They have ankle monitors that some people call alternatives to detention, but I don't call that alternatives to detention. That's almost another form of detention because they are monitored and keeping up the batteries, and a lot of the people have to pay for those themselves, and they're owned by private prisons. So what I'm advocating for is a supportive place for people to live while they're working on their immigration cases. Just like we used to have, or they used to be with their families. There, if they don't have families in the United States, asylum seekers, there have been some pilot programs that have done where they live in a home and they have a social worker, an attorney. Because if you have an attorney, you can win your case. People in detention, they don't have the rights that a U.S. citizen would have. They don't have the right to get a court-appointed attorney. They don't have the right to get a sentence because they're not there for a crime. So they can languish there for months and months. And if they do have an attorney, asylum seekers are shown to win their cases 5 times more often than if they don't have attorneys. So just for that reason, they should be able to live.
A good case for immigration attorneys.
Yeah, need a lot more attorneys and judges. But to live with their families or in some supportive system that's not immigration detention, which is all profit-driven. The whole thing was created for profit, for private prison companies and for other companies. So that's...
We can revisit that also. We have another caller, and I want to give them a chance. Douglas, thank you for your patience. You're on the air.
Yes, I had a question about the... Sorry, this is Douglas.
Yes.
And I had a question about the process in the past for seeking asylum, and how is that different since the Trump administration has come in?
Oh yes. It's like in the last couple of years they don't want people seeking asylum. We're trying to get zero people, even though it is a legal right. It used to be you go into the port of entry and I started talking about this a little bit before. If you go in between two ports of entry and go across illegally, it used to be you could still ask for asylum. And you would not get detained. But now it's a misdemeanor, and it's prosecutable, and you get put into detention and deportation system if you ask for asylum in between. So, but Gina's going to talk a little bit more about what it's like now.
Right. So we've heard – so – one of the things that used to happen would be the people would be safely released into the population to wait for their day in court. Now we have several different things. We have the zero tolerance policy from the administration, which resulted in family separation and children taking care of children and deaths of children in custody. Most of us are familiar with that, but then there's also the... remain in Mexico plan. It's officially named the Migrant Protection Protocol, but we sometimes refer to it as the Migrant Persecution Protocol, because here's the situation. You come to this country escaping violence. You ask for asylum. They take you through the first round of your credible fear interview. Maybe, if you're lucky, only 20% of the people who come here actually get asylum, seeking asylum, actually get asylum. But let's say you're lucky. You're part of that 20% that's going to get processed. But instead of being in the United States with a supportive sponsor, you're returned to Mexico. You don't know anybody in Mexico. You have, as our friend we met in Tijuana, 3 kids and a wife. You've sold everything you own to come here, and you have no work permit. You have nowhere to live. Many of these people are living under bridges. and that's the Remain or Return to Mexico program. There's also, well, you've heard about the Third Safe Country, right? Isn't that what that's called? And that is kind of ridiculous because there's nothing safe about Guatemala, Honduras, or El Salvador.
If they go, they're not allowed to go through a third country, then they're not allowed to ask
right,
for asylum.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. But the metering program is something I really want listeners to understand. Metering began in the spring of 2018. The increased use of it did. It was first instituted under the Obama administration, but it's been used more. And we were just down at the border a few months ago and a few weeks ago. And what happens is people are told to get in a line every day at 6 a.m. till 10 in the morning. They form this line in Tijuana at the crossing spot. And they are either in line to get a number or they are in line hoping their number will be called. And the numbers are up in the thousands. They wait in this line for 4 hours every day, hoping they'll get a number or hoping their number will be called. And it's happening up and down the border. It's not only in Tijuana. There's no real system. The numbers are given and called arbitrarily. Some day they may call three numbers. Some other day they may call no numbers. People are waiting under bridges because they're afraid they're going to lose their place or their number will be called and they won't know about it. So it's very, very ineffective. And it's effective in limiting the number of people, but it's not effective in processing people.
I want to back up. So you have no idea about how many people on a given day are going to be even talked to?
The day that we came there, there were three numbers called. It represented about 25 people or 20 people because the numbers are sometimes representing families, not
okay,
just one
individual,
person.
Okay.
But another day, there may be 10 numbers called. And there are people who volunteer with one organization in particular, Al Otro Lado, and they are, some of the volunteers are there just to watch that metering system to see that it's fair or to try to encourage people or, you know, the, I don't know exactly what they do there, but they're there every day watching that system, hoping for some bit of justice to occur. It's very sad, and when I think about it, it's hard not to to just feel hopeless. But we don't want people to feel hopeless.
I wanted to make them be hopeless a little bit first. I'm sorry. I wanted to add to something.
Please do.
You know, they've waited for a long time to get their number called, and they know that the numbers will be called. They find out what number they're on. That can be months before their number is finally
right.
called, and so they have to find shelters or somewhere to live during that time. Once their number is called,
Let me interject a question before
sure.
you get any further. Is the premise behind this possibly that the U.S. government, if they make enough of these people stay in Mexico before they cross the border, are they looking for a sympathetic our government looking for a sympathetic ear in Mexico that says, you know, we don't have room for these people, so you can't send them back here either?
They're trying to deter people, but they did. But Mexico is actually complicit right now because they're afraid their tariffs are going to go way up But they've agreed to it. But you know, they have their own issues in Mexico too. It's really hard. So, yeah.
Well, I would suppose if I were living in Mexico and there's this somewhat constant line of asylum seekers coming across through my area of the country, I would feel like there's a constant flow of people who lack resources, lack food, lack places to be able to sleep. So it's got to be a dilemma for the people in Mexico as to whether or not they try and lean on some of those refugees and asylum seekers to go back because they're in the way in Mexico.
That's very true. Okay. There's a lot of discrimination, especially toward the people from the African nations. A lot of racial discrimination. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of people in Mexico that don't like these immigrants either. I mean, I talked to someone who purported to work for a Mexican media outlet who was ranting and raving about this and saying he was,
extreme
and so,
media
but
outlet.
He sounded like some people we've heard here that are, you know, just want to lump everybody in one.
I do know some people in Tijuana category. Who have gotten 1 year humanitarian parole, and then they, you know, and then they are able to get a work permit and work legally as they're so and trying to. There are, there's a whole community called Little Haiti where they're actually starting to build some homes now, and they're realizing that they can maybe make a. They've kind of given up on coming to the U.S. And they are making a life. So there are people like that, too. However, I think what we're getting at is our government is trying to deter these people from coming rather than talking to Mexico, really. They're putting up all these barriers so that people won't even come. They don't want people to come. We didn't even mention the ice boxes.
Yeah.
If they do, when they do get across for their first interview and they actually have to go live in this very cold place that you've maybe heard about. And it used to be for maybe a week maximum, but it's very cold and they aren't even given clothing or blankets. You know, families in these places, we call them ice boxes. It's now like up to 2 weeks usually. And they come back with horrible stories. They're never the same again after that. And then they come back and then they go to the Return to Mexico or Remain in Mexico program and have to wait months again. So a lot of them end up leaving or, you know, just giving up. Or it's very dangerous, and they're targeted.
From what you said, though, I think to some extent there seems to be an effort from some people involved in this process that they would like more people to give up.
Yes.
Yes, I believe that's
definitely
true.
Definitely. They do all they can to set up barriers.
We'll get back to this. I want to remind folks, we are looking today at immigration issues at our border and how they affect our communities and beyond. I'm talking about Gina Whitaker and Jan Meslin. Today they're with Allies for Immigrant Justice, and Jan is also involved with an organization called Freedom for Immigrants. We're looking today at basically asylum seeker issues and how it's being addressed. This is obviously a question that that we're not going to be able to answer today, but we can have a dialogue because our guests today are people who are truly involved with it, both on a regional level and with some local individuals seeking asylum.
We would like to it's getting late in the hour, and we really feel it's important to name the three or four most important points that we would like our listeners to remember after today's broadcast.
All right, I'm going to hold you off just for a second.
Have a call?
We have a couple of calls coming in. So, Jack, you're on the air. Please go ahead. What are your questions or thoughts?
Real quickly, I'd just like to get your guest to comment on two things here. The blowback of our Monroe Doctrine, having the U.S. corporations go down there. United Fruit, we all know that, you know, getting the military to go down there, crush the labor unions, and this phony war on drugs, you know. We just had the president of Honduras with his brother involved with the whole trade. I'd like you to comment on that, which I think creates the gangs and the violence down there that the people are fleeing. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Thank you, Jack. Sure. I guess if I had to recommend a single resource for learning more about foreign policy in Latin America and U.S. foreign policy and how it has affected migration, I would have to say the film Harvest of Empire. This is available online, and it's available in the library. This film by Juan Gonzalez examines the history of U.S. foreign policy in Latin America over the past decades and the role of U.S. economic and military interests that they've played in destabilizing that region. NAFTA in 1994 was the most common, the one we know about most, but even though it was, it came about during the Clinton administration, it basically completely inundated the Mexican corn economy and wiped it out. People were buying corn from the U.S. rather than from Mexican farmers. Mexican farmers couldn't feed their children, and they were forced to come to the U.S. to work. Our government needs to be more mindful of the unintended consequences that might occur with some of these agreements. And this film, Harvest of Empire, will give you a really, really strong background in how this has worked to create more migration from these countries.
Yeah, we have another caller, and I want to make sure we get him a chance to be in here, too. Bill, you're on the air.
Yeah, I've got a quick question that doesn't really relate to what you're talking about, but maybe
that's okay, Bill. Yeah, we give you permission to do that. It's okay.
Okay, and that is what about immigrants and refugees from Orange County and from Nebraska that want to come to California, and specifically San Luis Obispo County, and what effect it's having on homelessness, high home prices, traffic, water usage, and all those things.
I believe, Bill, that's probably a topic for another program, but you bring up some interesting points to discuss. Thanks for the call.
Okay, bye.
So,
to your list, Gina, let's go ahead. I'm sorry. Thank you.
What we would love the listeners to remember are a few things today. One of them is respect and dignity for all, including those immigrants from Orange County like Jan. We want to have respect and dignity for all. We believe that all of those who come to our borders seeking to make a better life for themselves in the U.S. should be treated at least with respect and dignity. This includes asylum seekers or people fighting deportation orders, those who are undocumented, DACA students, people who are living in the shadows. And the narrative coming from this administration is that what's happening at the border is an invasion of the homeland. But from what we've discussed and the evidence that we've seen, we strongly see that this points to being a humanitarian crisis and not an invasion. Another thing that we would like people to take away is that we would like you to have hope. And that Jan's going to address that.
I have hope. I'm not necessarily optimistic, but I have hope, and we want you to have hope. It's so easy to get discouraged, and we still need to have hope. And the reason we have hope is because we see what is happening, and there's wonderful people and organizations doing amazing things in the United States and also in Tijuana, because we've taken several trips down there. Nicole Ramos, a feisty young immigration lawyer from New Jersey who works with Alo Chorolato to assist asylum seekers. And when we were there, there were all these volunteers, lots of people from the U.S., and they weren't all lawyers, and they didn't all speak Spanish, but they were helping all these people to determine if they could get asylum, possibly. Pastor Gustavo and his wife, Pastora Zaida, they are in Scorpion Canyon working in a poor Tijuana neighborhood to provide shelter and food for families seeking asylum against incredible odds. And they'll take everybody. And they don't even have a limit on how long people stay. We saw many Haitians living there, and we also saw Central Americans living there. Wonderful couple. There's other shelters doing great work, too. Young people, DACA students, undocumented and afraid, fighting for their families.
Unafraid.
Yes, sorry. Some of the legislators give us hope. Our California governor gave us hope this week when he signed AB 32, which will ban all private detention centers from operating in California when their contracts run out. And to me, the immigrants themselves are really what give me the most hope. I have visited so many people in detention over the years, and the stories that I hear and the way they stay so resilient, they miss their families. They have jobs waiting for them and homes waiting, but they're stuck in detention. But yet they pull through and they're strong. And they are just thankful and they just keep working. When they get out, then they get involved in the system oftentimes to improving the system. So we've got many friends and they're very courageous and they give us hope. And when I take action, it makes me feel better. When I see others dedicating their lives to people in need, that gives me hope, and it moves me to take action.
And the last thing we'd like to leave you with is to educate yourself and take action. We encourage people to educate themselves about these complex issues and take action. We have a website, alliesforimmigrationjustice.org, and we have an action page on that website, things that you can do to show that you care about this issue. We run a one-day visitation over to Bakersfield to Mesa Verde each month.
That's the closest detention center.
Exactly, and Jan's going there tomorrow, and she can take somebody in her car. Anyone who wants to come, please call the station. Let us know. October 27th. Not this Sunday, but the following. We're having a wonderful event at the Unitarian Universalist Church. We are going to be writing letters and making cards for detainees. We're going to be learning more about privatized detention centers, and we're going to hear from the folks who run the visitation program over at Mesa Verde. So this is free and open to the public October 27th from 1 to 3 at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, 2201 Lawton Avenue in San Luis Obispo.
What's our website again?
Our website is alliesforimmigrationjustice.org.
We have a few more minutes left. I'm still concerned about something that we may not be able to address, but does concern me as we look at this, and that is a tremendous number of the immigrants that are here currently illegally have jobs. They seem to have jobs in a lot of cases for, frankly, working for rather well-connected conservative organizations. Esquire magazine about a year ago, and I wish I could remember the name of the article, I'll find it somewhere, is Esquire magazine about a year ago ran an article about dairy farms in Iowa that was actually tied to some questions, some political questions about some things going on in the Bakersfield area, and it led to Iowa. And we'll leave that at that. But what they discovered was 90% of the people who were working on Iowa dairy farms as labor were indeed illegal immigrants. And this was a community that was considered, that still is considered, one of the most conservative regions of the country. And actually, some of the most conservative members of Congress come from that region. And I'm wondering whether or not this is a discussion that among your peers in organizations like this, you're talking about how much of this is, for lack of a better word, somewhat exploitive of the people who are here illegally because, oh, come work for me. Mm-hmm. I'll pay you substandard wages, and we'll pretend like you're really not working here, or whatever, or we'll find you a bogus Social Security number. And it seems, from what we're reading in what I consider to be valid media, not politically slanted media, a notice or being on notice to some extent that some of the more conservative business people in the country are the people who are indeed hiring the people who are coming here illegally.
Hmm.
Because they see them as cheaper labor than legal residents.
Well, I think that goes back to the question of immigrants are taking American jobs. If the employers choose to pay sub-minimum wages, they may only be able to get people who are struggling and living in fear. They won't complain about those wages, or they won't complain about the theft of those wages if they don't get paid, because they feel like that will draw ICE to them and then they'll be deported. So yes, it's a big issue. It's not one that I have a lot of knowledge about, but I think it's important to find out from those companies, why are you hiring people who are undocumented, and how does that work with your bottom line?
Yeah,
I got to have time to put a plug in for my deported veteran friends.
Yes.
Whenever we go to Tijuana, we visit the deported veterans, U.S. Unified Deported Veterans Office. And a lot of people don't even know there are deported veterans. But this was another thing that started with the 1996 law, when you could detain and deport green card people. That was the first time that had happened. And they've served their time. They get honorably discharged, and then they have PTSD, and if they get in any kind of trouble, or if they're even if somebody accuses them of a crime, they are in the detention and deportation system. It's awful. These wonderful people, and it just adds to all the stories. These people have been willing to give their lives for us, and they feel like they're U.S. citizens. While they're over in Iraq or Afghanistan, they come back, and all of a sudden they're not, and then they find themselves in trouble and deported. And there's a whole network. The U.S. government doesn't keep track of how many. There's a young man right now, Jose Segovia Benitez, who was deported yesterday to El Salvador, but because of all of our advocacy, he has been stopped. And I think they're sending him back to the detention center. I'm not sure.
And
but
this is a Marine,
yeah.
It's a Marine
this
veteran.
This is a Marine veteran. You probably read about him,
yeah.
Huh? Well,
yeah.
He actually didn't get deported, and so we're still working for him. I'm friends with his family in Long Beach.
Okay.
Anyway, there's a lot of deported veterans, and this is an issue that really all people should – it's a bipartisan thing.
Yeah. Gina, we have some parting thoughts for you.
I think my parting thought is get involved and educate yourself. Watch films, read books, meet people. Come to one of our border trips. There are two border trips a year I could connect you with. They're only 4 days long. They're not very expensive. Everything is provided, and you get to meet people and see what NGOs are doing in Tijuana. It's a wonderful trip, so that's another opportunity.
I'll remind our listeners also that this program is archived on the KCBX website. So if there's information and contact information or your website information, they can also listen to the program. It'll be usually posted on the air by about this evening or tomorrow morning, so people can listen to it and get some more details for you also.
Thank you.
We're about out of time. I wanted to thank you both for being with us today. I think this is a topic that is A, not going to go away, and B, needs to be looked at more, from my personal opinion, as a humanitarian issue
thank
and not
you.
A political issue. But I thank you for joining us today. As you know, this is Central Coast Voices, and thank you for all listening with us today. Next week, Chris Kington Barker will be here, and she'll be speaking with guests from the Diversity Coalition of San Luis Obispo County. She'll have board members Cornell Morton and Kendra Paulding. And they're going to discuss how their work to provide programs and resources to celebrate diversity in our community is important. They're promoting the real understanding within our community of a more integrated community that we can learn to understand and work with our neighbors in a better environment. That'll be a great program next week. Not inconsistent with what we're talking about today. Mm-hmm. Central Coast Voices, as I've told you before, and I'll tell you again, is a project of Action for Healthy Communities, which is a project of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. Action for Healthy Communities does a snapshot of the community every 3 years in what is called the Vital Signs Report. You can find the most recent report at actionslo.org. Want to thank our underwriting, which comes from Joan Gellert Sargent. She's a continuous underwriter of this program, and we thank her for her support. You can contact us at voices@kcbx.org or 805-543-2323. Want to also thank the KCBX Public Radio for being a partner in letting us put this program on and make you part of our community, because this is public radio, and public radio means radio that is shared by our listeners, not just by us. And thank you to Gina Whitaker and Jan Meslin for being with us today. This has been Central Coast Voices. Coming up next is This American Life, frankly, my favorite program on KCBX. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Fred.